Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Tonight we are very pleased to have Cory Doctorow with us, a sci-fi novelist, co-editor of the popular blog Boing Boing, and a contributor to worldwide opinion pages and magazines. He is a technology activist and consultant to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil liberties and technology nonprofit. We will be hearing about both of those aspects of his career. As he tells us about his new book, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, about creativity in the digital age. Please help us welcome Cory Doctorow.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Thanks for coming. Thank you to the Tattered Cover for hosting me. I'm a recovering bookseller, and stores like this I dote on. They are so amazing, and you are very lucky to live in a large city with a giant, awesome bookstore, because most people don't. That age seems to have passed in most of America and Canada and the United Kingdom, and so count your blessings and help support the store and keep it alive. So, like many of you, I earn my living online, and even if you're not earning your living online today, the chances are you'll be earning your living online tomorrow in whole or in part, because everything we do today involves the internet, and everything we do tomorrow will require the internet. And there's a wonderful thing about earning a living from creative labor, which is that everyone does it a little differently. In fact, everyone does it a lot differently. When you start looking closely at the incomes of people who are successful in the arts, what you find is that none of them are doing the same thing, even if it looks externally like they're all doing the same thing. They have different ways that they earn their living, different reasons that they do it, different proportions of their life given over to different kinds of production, performance, and so on. So it's great because you can carve your own way through the world, something that works just for you. But the downside is that because there's no ordained way to earn a living from the arts, there's no way to predict whether or not anything you do is going to work. And in fact, almost everything people try to earn a living from the arts fails, right? There are trillions of ways to lose money at the arts, and there's only a couple million ways to earn money at the arts. So your odds are not great. But that's true independent of how you're trying to make art. And it's also true independently of when you are trying to make your art, what technology is around. That's always been true. There's never been a copyright system that made even a small percentage of the people who wanted to make art rich or even give them any kind of income. There's never been one that resulted in anything but most of those people losing money. We have what economists call confirmation bias or survivor bias. The only artists we know about from times gone by are the ones who succeeded, because the ones who didn't succeed didn't make any kind of artistic mark on our landscape. And so when we think about earlier eras, you know, the heroic era of the pocket novel or the heroic era of the 45 RPM record, the only people we have a strong record of are the ones who succeeded, who were the tiny fraction at the top. A living in the creative fields is so rare that it's what statisticians call Six Sigma events, something that almost never happens. But there's a funny thing about something that almost never happens, is if you try it often enough, it'll happen eventually. So imagine a firing line spread out all the way down the Colorado River of people flipping coins, right? Most of those people, their coin is going to come either heads or tails, but a very small number of those people will get their coins to land on the edge, right? A very small number. But if enough of them do it for enough time, some of them will. Now, if you spent every waking moment flipping coins, you'd have a better chance of getting your coin to land on edge than someone who didn't. And if you practice it, you could probably get a little better. There's probably some techniques that help with the edge, coin landing on the edge. But if you surveyed all the people whose coins landed on edge, the thing that they had in common more than anything else is luck, right? The confluence of working hard, persevering, practicing, having some talent, but mostly getting lucky. Now, if the people who won those edge-on coin tosses were lionized, if they were hailed as kind of heroes of coin tossing, and moreover, if tossing coins and getting them to land on the edge was something that seemed like intrinsic to the human condition and deeply satisfying, you could imagine that there'd be a lot of coin tossing and that we'd really venerate the coin tossers. And I think this is not a bad analogy to the arts. After all, making art is intrinsic to human beings, right? Babies make art. They do finger painting. They sing songs. They tell stories. People who come back from war or tragedy with horrible PTSD, we do art therapy with them, and it heals them. Singing and telling stories and making pictures, these seem to be intrinsic to the human condition. Our earliest records of human society are things like cave paintings and sculptures. So successful artists get treated with that reverence. It sometimes borders on worship, so you can understand why lots of people want to make art. But the arts are not a market activity, fundamentally. Like, economically, if you're sitting down to say, you know, I know what I'm going to do to feed my family, I'll make art, right? You are not being realistic. You're setting out to win this edge-on coin-tossing contest, where beyond trying a lot and practicing a lot, you can't win without getting very, very lucky. So when we talk about the internet and people who make a living from the arts, we tend to focus on whether or not the new stuff that's coming out will serve the artists who are currently earning a living well. Right? Is this good for book writers? And when we say, is it good for book writers, we mean, is it good for the people who are writing books today? And the implication is that the only kind of book writer there is the kind of book writer that's here today. But the kind of book writer we have has changed every time technology has changed. And down that firing line, all the way down the Colorado River, there are people trying every strategy imaginable to toss a coin. And when the winds change, no matter which way they're blowing, there's someone who's tossing their coin in a way that's optimal for that wind. And no matter what technology is doing, there are some people who the technology will make into winners. And when we go to war against an individual business model, when we say, oh, well, yeah, it's one thing for people to go off and earn their living, you know, with Kickstarter, but that's what do we do about the people who earn their living from record labels? What we do if we say, well, we have to, it's one or the other, is we go to war against the social factors, the economic factors, the technological factors that are making Kickstarter successful today. And we do so at the expense of all of those future lottery winners waiting in the wings, right? Waiting to come forward. So on the one hand, it's not a good deal for all those artists who would be succeeding if we let those new models flourish. But on the other hand, it has these knock-on effects in all these technologies that are emerging and in all the other things they do, because, you know, the arts aren't why our technology develops. Our technology develops for lots of other things to help us communicate, mostly. And the arts are just what happens off to the side. And so what you end up doing is resonating through all those other domains. The cure is usually worse than the disease. Now, I happen to be someone who's won the lottery, right? The business models of the last couple of decades have done really well for me. And I want to keep on winning the lottery. I want to find business models that succeed in the future. But I don't think that we should be trying to figure out how to make sure that no matter what happens, I continue to earn a living from my books. What I do think we should be doing is making sure that whatever books are being published and whoever is writing them and however people are getting paid for them, that the first bite at the apple, the first preferential tranche of the money that comes in goes to the writers, goes to the artists, goes to the musicians, right? They deserve the first cut. The second cut should go to the people who invest in their works, the publishers, the studios, the labels, especially when it's capital-intensive works, because that way you get more people investing in the works. Sometimes there's no capital involved in their work, right? All I need to do my work is, you know, a pen and some paper, and so I'm the investor in my work. The last people who get the cut at the apple, I think, should be the platforms, the intermediaries, the retailers, the payment processors, and so on. But we've arrayed things in our policy about the arts and technology such that the people who get paid first are the platforms, Google, Apple, and so on. And the people who get paid second are the investors, the publishers, the studios, the labels. And the crumbs that are left over, if we're lucky, go to the artists who make the work that we love. So tonight, and in this book, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, I'm going to propose three ironclad laws for fixing this. Things that publishers can do, things that policymakers can do, things that we can choose as artists and as people who love art, audiences, that will help remedy the situation. So I have these three laws. And before I tell you what the laws are, I have to tell you how I got three laws. So I travel a lot. I live in the United Kingdom, as you can tell from my accent. And I often cross the ocean to talk to people on this side of the world. And the day after I land, it's always weird because I'll have spent the night up in a hotel room with horrible jet lag, trying to get to sleep, failing, and then trying to get some productive work done and having kind of vivid hallucinations while I try. It's not always bad, but it's always weird. And so one day I was attending a speaking at a conference on publishing in New York, and there was in a Times Square hotel, and there I was, 2 a.m, up in my hotel, and I came up with this law, Doctorow's Law, which seemed like a good idea at 2 a.m. And it went over well the next morning when I gave the keynote, and then there's this thing that you're like obliged to do if you're a writer and you're in New York, which is you have to make your agent take you out for lunch, right? That's like part of the package. So my agent took me out for lunch, and I told him about this. My agent's this guy, Russ Galen, who, among other things, he represents Arthur C. Clarke, you know, first Clarke when he was alive, now his estate. And I said, Russ, I've got this law, and it went over well. And he said, you know, Corey, if there's one thing I learned representing Arthur, it's that you got to have 3 laws. So I have 3 laws. So the first law, law number one, Doctorow's first law, used to be just Doctorow's law, is anytime someone puts a lock on something that belongs to you and won't give you the key, that lock is not there for your benefit. So if you've ever made some art and then uploaded it to the internet so that you can sell it to other people through a platform like Amazon or Apple or the Google Play Store, when you're uploading it, there's a tick box. And that tick box says, would you like to protect your work? And I think most people, when asked the question that way, say yes, they tick it off. And actually, if you publish through a major publisher or studio or label, chances are they're ticking that box themselves when they use the platforms. And what that does when you tick the box is it adds something called digital rights management, or sometimes called digital locks, to the work. And it scrambles the work, it encrypts the work, and that is meant to somehow stop people from using the work without your permission, pirating the work. And that's the idea of this lock, is it's supposed to protect your income by making sure that the only people who read pay, the only people who use pay, right? So you're always getting paid when people use your stuff. But it doesn't do a very good job. And to understand why it doesn't do a very good job, we have to do a little quick kind of 2-minute primer on how cryptography works. It's cryptography without the math. So don't worry if math's not your thing. Crypto is pretty important, so like understanding this is a good idea anyways if you're alive in the 21st century. So in cryptography, like our most basic example involves 3 people, Alice, Bob, and Carol. These people are like locked in so many examples from cryptography that people now write love songs about them. So Alice and Bob are friends. They like each other. And Carol is their enemy, evil Carol. I sometimes use Clapper here, but I'll stick with Carol. And Alice and Bob are sending each other messages back and forth, and Carol wants to read those messages, and Alice and Bob want her to stop from reading those messages. So Alice and Bob are developing some cryptographic tools, some scrambling stuff to stop Carol from reading their message. And Alice and Bob, they have what's called a threat model, right? That's like what you think your enemy is able to do. What's your enemy capable of doing? And that's what you try to design your threat model around. Like, you know, if you're trying to stop people from breaking into your house, you design your lock so that it's proof against people who might want to pick the lock, but you don't design it so it's proof against, like, Delta Force ninjas with battering rams, right? Your threat model is, like, burglars, not state-level actors, right? So their threat model here is that Carol is in possession of 2 really important facts about their message. The first one is that she can get a copy of their scrambled message. They assume that Carol knows the message is there and that she can snag a copy. Now, this seems counterintuitive. Why do they assume this? Well, because these days we send messages through networks that lots of other people are part of, right? Like, I might send it over radio using a cellular phone or a wireless internet access point. And so anyone who's within the footprint of the radio, they can hear the message, right? They can grab a copy of the message. Maybe I'm sending it over the internet, right? And so, like, the phone company might be Carol and get a copy of the message, or someone who works there, or someone who works at the phone company your phone company connects to. Maybe it even goes over a satellite link. Well, satellites, they blanket a whole continent with a copy of your message, right? Everyone on the continent can get a copy of her message. So Carol probably has, it's safer to assume Carol has a copy of the message that it's been scrambled. Alice and Bob also think that Carol knows what they did to scramble it, right? In fact, they tell everybody how they're scrambling their message. They publish it. Why would you publish your method for scrambling things. It's like publishing schematics for your lock, which, incidentally, we do for exactly the same reason. Well, the reason you tell people why you're how you scramble is because people have an endless capacity for self-deception. We make mistakes, and then we kid ourselves that we haven't made any mistakes. This is not a new observation. In fact, it's the whole basis of science. Right? Before we had science, we had a thing that looked a lot like science that was called alchemy. And alchemists were trying to convert base metals like lead into gold. That was their big project. And alchemists were worried that whoever got there first, whoever made the first lead into gold, that person would make so much gold that after they got rich, gold would be worthless. So the alchemists were in competition with each other, and they kept what they thought they knew a secret. So every time they thought they learned something, they'd write it down in a book, but they wouldn't tell anyone else what they learned. Ironically, they'd use codes. Even more ironically, those codes were probably broken because they didn't tell anyone what their how their codes worked. So they would use these codes to write down their messages. They wouldn't tell anyone. That meant that every alchemist discovered for himself in the hardest way possible that drinking mercury was a really bad idea, right? The 500-year period during which alchemists were trying to do alchemy, we call that the Dark Ages. Right? Now, alchemy started to become science when alchemists actually did some alchemy. They converted something base into something precious. They converted superstition into knowledge. And they did it by publishing what they thought they knew and letting their colleagues tell them how wrong they were. And when your colleagues tell you how wrong you are and you have to validate your assumptions and the things you think you know in a process of adversarial peer review, you get better. And that's that moment at which alchemists started publishing, we call that the Enlightenment. And the thing that they did after they started publishing, we call that science. So we don't have an experimental methodology for finding out whether your security system works. Bruce Schneier says anyone can design a security system that works so well that he can't think of a way to break it. All that means is that you've designed a security system that works on people who are stupider than you. Right? Unless you tell people why you think your security system works, it probably doesn't. Think of this the next time you ask the TSA why you're taking your shoes off, and they say, I'd tell you, but I'd have to kill you. Right? So Alice and Bob, they tell everyone how their scrambling system works, their algorithm works, because they want to find the mistakes. So how is it that if Carol has the scrambled message and knows how it was scrambled, that she can't read the message? Well, that's because cryptography comes in two parts, the scrambling system and the key that's used to scramble it. It's like a lock and a key. And cryptography, the math tells us, and this is the only reference to the math in this part of the talk, the math tells us that if you don't know the key, you can't unscramble the message. Like if you took all the hydrogen atoms in the universe and you turned them into computers and they ground away on that scrambled message, trying random keys between now and the heat death of the universe, you would run out of universe before you ran out of combinations. Right? So we can keep secrets if we can keep the key secret. So Alice and Bob have lots of clever ways of exchanging keys with one another. And so long as Carol doesn't get the key, Alice and Bob are sailing. So how do digital locks work? Okay, well, I'm Netflix, and you're you, and I want to give you a copy of a movie, but I don't want you to save that movie because I want you to stay as a subscriber, and I think you might be someone who only has like 7 favorite movies, and if you can just download those, you'll cancel your Netflix subscription, right? So I give you the scrambled movie, which you can't watch, and then I give you a Netflix player, right, a program, an app, that has the keys to scramble the movie. And so long, and that program, if you go to the little like file menu, it doesn't have a save button, right? So you can't save the movie, right? Well, you can't save the movie unless you can figure out where in that program the key is. And if you can figure out where in that program the key is hiding, you can make your own client and you can put a little save button in it. And the thing is, maybe you can't do that, right? Maybe I can't do that. But someone can do it, because it's really hard to hide something in a thing that you give to someone else that you expect that they won't find. It's like saying, we made this bank safe that is so kicking that we filled it with money and put it in the bank robber's living room. Right? We know why we don't do that. It doesn't matter how kicking your safe is. And in this model, there isn't Alice and Bob and Carol, there's just Alice and Bob. Alice gives Bob the scrambled message. Or Bob gives Alice the scrambled message. Bob gives Alice the key to scramble the message. Bob doesn't tell Alice where the key is, and Bob hopes that Alice won't find the key. In cryptography, the technical term for this is wishful thinking. Because if you want to be Alice, all you need to do is get a Netflix subscription. Right? Anyone who wants to can become Alice, including like bored grad students with nothing to do this weekend and their own electron tunneling microscope. They're all Alice. And so these digital locks, they don't survive contact with the world. They're broken within hours by teenagers for giggles, almost instantaneously. But people keep doing them. Why do they keep doing them? Because the thing that protects digital locks isn't technology, it's law. All over the world, we have laws that make it a crime to figure out where the keys are, to tell people where the keys are, to make your own player with your own set of keys, to communicate information that would help people make their own player or find the keys. In the United States, there's a law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA. If you're familiar with those terms, it's probably because they made all your favorite videos on YouTube, right? This video has been removed thanks to a claim from under the DMCA. In the rest of the world, they have their own versions of this because the U.S. Trade Representative has gone to all the countries in the world and said, if you're going to buy and sell with America, you will pass your own version of these laws. Canada has Bill C-11, New Zealand has Bill 92A, in the European Union, we have the European Union Copyright Directive. Basically, if you've got electricity, you've got this law all over the world. Now, this doesn't stop people from pirating stuff, of course, right? If you're already willing to violate copyright law, the fact that you're also violating a different copyright law isn't much of an impediment, right? Like, oh, I was all set to do the wrong thing, but since you've told me that I'll also do this other wrong thing if I do, I've changed my mind, right? That doesn't work. But it has another effect. So the way these laws are written is very specific and not accidental. And the laws are written so that the only person who's allowed to remove a lock is the company that made the lock. So if you say to Amazon, yeah, okay, put your lock on my work so it'll only run on Kindles, and the Kindle will protect it if no one can make an alternative player for Kindle books, only Amazon is allowed to tell your customers, your readers, that they can take the book off their Kindle and put it on a competing device or in a competing ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Well, Amazon wants your customers locked to their store, right? Like if every time you bought a book at BNN, they said, by the way, you have to buy the bookcase at IKEA, right? That would be like a super good deal for BNN, and it'd be a super good deal for IKEA. It would be really bad for publishers and writers. Because if you decided that you didn't like the deal you were getting from Barnes & Noble, and you said, from now on, I only sell my books through glorious independent stores like this one, people who bought their books here would have to have a different room with different bookcases and different light bulbs and a different chair to read those books. And they'd have to remember where they kept the books when they wanted to read them, which library it was in. So you create these impediments to people leaving the Amazon store when you let Amazon lock up your work, or the Apple store when you let Apple lock up your work, or the Google store when you let Google lock up your work. How does that play out in the real world? Well, whenever you get into a dispute, whenever publishers get into disputes with platforms, if they've been dumb enough to use these digital locks, they lose. Hachette is one of the big five publishers. We only have five big publishers left in the world. They're responsible for imprints like Little Brown or Orbit, you've probably heard of. And Hachette is like really foursquare for digital locks. All their books have digital locks on them. And Hachette has got into this big fight with Amazon. Amazon wanted more money from the Hachette books they sold. And Hachette said, no, we're not going to do that. And Amazon said, fine, you can't sell your books here in the Amazon store anymore. So like if you've got the first five Harry Potter books from us at Amazon, the six and seven aren't for sale on Amazon anymore. And what Hachette thought would happen is that people would just start buying their Hachette books on other stores, on BarnesandNoble.com, on Kobo.com, on Google Play, on Apple. But what actually happened was that people were so reluctant to abandon their Amazon libraries that they, at the end of a year, Hachette had to capitulate and give Amazon practically everything they wanted. Right? That's what happens when you let other people put their locks on your work and not give you the key. And this is only getting started, right? Amazon's book business looks really competitive next to their audiobook business. They own a publisher called Audible. If you like audiobooks, you've heard of Audible because they are responsible for 90% of the audiobook sales in the market. They're the only people allowed to sell on the iTunes store too, right? They're the major supplier. Audible doesn't give you the choice of whether or not you want to lock your works to their platform. You are required to lock your books to Audible. Now, Audible is an Amazon division, and Amazon is known as this, like, super competitive cutthroat organization. And Amazon did not take all of the cutthroat competitive people and put them in the other divisions, and take all the, like, Pegasisters and Bronies and people who follow the Grateful Dead and put them in Audible, right? The degree of corporate sociopathy in Amazon is normalized. The same cutthroat people work at Audible as work in all the other divisions. And so I will bet you a testicle, although not one of mine, that we will see a huge fight between Audible and the audiobook publishers, because they're already putting the squeeze on them. And almost every audiobook sold in this century is locked to Audible's platform. So anytime someone promises that they're going to help you by putting a lock on your stuff, but won't give you the key, that lock isn't there for your benefit. That's the first law. The second law, fame won't make you rich, but you can't sell your art without it, right? Tim O'Reilly is this great guy. You've been to food camp with me. It's a thing that he convened. Tim coined the term Web 2.0. He coined the term open source. And he's always busting out these killer aphorisms that people are like, yeah, that's the truth of the internet. So one of the things he said that everybody gives some time to that I think is a very true thing. One of the things he said was, for most artists, the problem isn't piracy, it's obscurity, right? The reason people aren't buying your work isn't because it's been pirated, it's because no one's ever heard of it. Totally true, but I think people misinterpret him routinely. I think when people think about what Tim said, what they think is that he said, if you're famous enough, you'll be rich. This is completely untrue, and it's not what Tim said. There is no amount of Facebook likes that's going to put braces on your kids' teeth or pay your mortgage. In order to convert the fact that people like your stuff to money, you have to perform alchemy. You have to somehow convert affection to cash. And there's no obvious way to do that. As I said at the beginning, there's millions of ways to do it and trillions of ways to fail to do it. But in the 21st century, the way that people discover your stuff so they can give you money for it is on the internet. Right, they hear about you through a search engine or social media or through an online hosting provider like YouTube. And although there are trillions of ways to fail to earn money and millions of ways to earn money, they all fall into about six categories. And those six categories have been around since time immemorial, although how we do them changes from time to time. So the ways that people earn money from their art, they sell their art, right? Paintings, CDs, books. They sell merchandise, T-shirts, posters, their guitar picks, George Foreman grills, right? They sell ads, right? Lots of ad-supported media in the age of the internet. We see that a lot. They sell commissions. So they get super famous giving stuff away, and then people who do have a way to make money, like maybe ad agencies or big companies, they come along and they say, I know that you make art for yourself, and that's great. Make some art for me, and I'll give you a lot of money, because I'm so impressed with the art that you make for yourself. So they sell those commissions. Sometimes they sell tickets, right? This is a really old business model. You've got like a hall that's got a door. There's a guy at the door who's got his arms folded, and he won't let you in unless you buy a ticket. Right? It's a pretty good business model. Or they have patrons, right? In the old days, if you were like a Venetian sculptor, you convinced the Medicis or the Pope that you had something great to make, right? You get to paint this totally kicking ceiling. Today, you go to Kickstarter. Right? That's the half dozen ways that people have ever earned their living from the arts. How we do it changes from time to time. What we do doesn't change. But the ways that we get paid are also all online, right? The money comes to you through a payment processor like Square or PayPal, or it comes to you through an ad broker like Google, or it comes to you from a crowdfunding platform like Indiegogo or Kickstarter. So the internet has spawned a lot of independent successes. People who didn't go to the publishers, the studios, the labels to earn their livings, who instead of doing that, they took all these pieces lying around on the internet, what in copyright circles we call intermediaries, the payment processors, the ad brokers, the online hosting platforms, and they globbed them all together and they made themselves a publisher or a record label or a film production studio by using parts of it. They collect the money through PayPal, they advertise it through Google AdWords, they show it on YouTube, right? That's how people are doing it. Now, some of those independent successes, they were artists who started out in the mainstream world, right? They had a publisher who backed them, and they got some measure of fame and fortune, and then either they got pissed off with their investors, or their investors kicked them out the door, right? Some of those people are, you'll be familiar with, like Amanda Palmer or Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails, and they went independent. So they leveraged their reputations to go indie, and they did very well. Some people went the other way. Some people started indie and ended up in the mainstream. Hugh Howey wrote this book, Wool. Amazing book. He sold it himself through the Kindle store. It became such a bestseller that he then did a deal with Simon & Schuster, one of the big five publishers. Or Randy Monroe, who does XKCD, did it for years, made his money selling T-shirts, was kind of living the dream. He had a ball pit in his living room. He played Xbox and made one comic a week and then opened checks, right? But he got this awesome deal with Simon & Schuster and had this number one bestseller off the back of that. Now, some artists who start indie stay indie. So like Jonathan Coulton was a programmer who released a song every week on YouTube. People liked his music. He started touring with it. He started selling independent tracks. He got some commissions. If you've ever played Portal, that song at the end, Still Alive, that's Joko's. But he never went to a label. Right, he's still indie, although you can hear him on NPR. If that counts as commercial, I guess he's commercial. I don't think it counts as commercial. Now, the world of big content, the people who invest in creative works, they've been squeezed down to a small number of companies just like every other sector, just like bookselling or oil or finance or advertising. Something is at work in the wider world that is reducing the number of companies and making those companies bigger. And when there are fewer buyers for your work, you as the seller get a worse deal. This is economics 101. When there's hundreds of record labels, one of them will probably offer you a better deal than the others. When there's four record labels, the chances are they're all going to offer you pretty much the same deal. And there are four record labels left in the world, major record labels. There's five movie studios and five publishers left in the world. And not surprisingly, the deal that they offer to us when we create works and give them to them to invest in and take out to the world, that deal is bad. If you're a label, if you're signed to a label, you know, you're the 1% of 1% of 1% of the musicians whose coin landed on edge and you got a record deal, your record deal with the big four has this non-negotiable clause that says your royalties will have a deduction every time, the money they give you will have a deduction every 6 months for something called breakage. Right, a percentage of the money you earn for them is deducted for breakage. What's breakage? It's the percentage of shellac 78 RPM records that they expect to see broken between the factory and the store. And it's deducted from your MP3 royalties. Right? Why is it deducted from your MP3 royalties? Because there's only four of them. That's why. Right? If you don't like it, try getting a better deal somewhere else. Lily Tomlin used to say on Saturday Night Live, we don't have to care, we're the phone company, right? If you're a writer, if you write novels like me, chances are if you're signing to one of the big five, they not only want your novel rights, but they want your translation rights. They want worldwide English rights, not just US-Canadian rights. They want your graphic novel rights. Some of them are asking for film rights, audiobook rights. And it's not like they're paying what you used to get if you sold all those rights individually. They're just paying what they used to pay just for the first North American rights. But they're getting all these other rights and subcontracting them out and keeping the money for themselves. So the existence of this independent channel represents a competitor of last resort when we're negotiating with our investors, right? The worst deal one of the big five or the big four can offer you has to be better than the best deal you think you'll get for yourself if you walk out the door and make your own publisher out of parts you found lying around on the internet. So every one of those independent successes increases the expected return to people who aren't independent, right? The better they do, the better we do. Now, not surprisingly, the entertainment industry has been at war with the intermediaries that allow independents to go indie since the very first days of the internet. So it used to be that you weren't responsible if you had a place where people could post things to the internet and they infringed on copyright, they broke copyright, wasn't your business. Then they passed this law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and they said, okay, it's your business to the extent you have to remove anything that infringes copyright if you're informed of it. So if someone says to you, I say that infringes copyright, without any proof, without any evidence, you have to take it down. And you have to pay someone to watch those requests as they come in and take them down quickly, because otherwise you're on the hook for damages, and the damages for infringement are $150,000 in civil liability and $250,000 in statutory liability per infringement. So now you have to pay staffers to do that. But that wasn't enough. Over time, the amount of money that you had to spend to start and run an internet business went up and up to do this compliance stuff, to make sure that you're on the right side of copyright law. When YouTube started, it was three guys in a garage and a pile of hard drives. But over time, YouTube got into these long policy fights with the studios and the labels, who said, you're not doing enough. Even though the law says all you have to do is take stuff down when we tell you it infringes, we actually expect you to automatically detect whether or not something infringes. So they built this thing. It cost hundreds of millions of dollars. It's called Content ID. And what it tries to do is automatically detect whether or not you're infringing. Well, competing video services that start up, if they get sued, one of the facts that will be in the case is they're not doing everything they can. They're not doing what's industry standard. Did you see what YouTube is doing? Now, YouTube put Content ID in place, so they didn't put in place a system that was too expensive for themselves to run, right? They put in place something that they themselves could afford. But that doesn't mean anyone can afford it. That doesn't mean that YouTube, when it started, could afford it. Three guys in a garage, a pile of hard drives, and $200 million worth of compliance ware is really different from three guys in a garage and a pile of hard drives. And as a result, we don't see a lot of new YouTubes popping up. Well, what happens when there's not much competition for in the intermediary sector, when there aren't a ton of payment processors competing for our business, when there aren't a ton of hosting providers competing for our business? Well, the deal they offer us gets worse. So YouTube is starting a Spotify competitor, streaming music. They took the four labels and they put them in a room and they negotiated with them in private and secret and came up with a deal that the four labels were happy with and could afford and accorded with their business priorities. And then they went to all the independent labels out there and all the independent musicians who use YouTube and they said, the four labels have decided what the deal is that the independents are going to get. You don't have to take it, but if you don't, you're not allowed to use YouTube anymore to promote your videos. And try running a record label without videos on YouTube. And as a consequence, all of the labels are starting to do what the Big Four have told them they must, which means that the idea that the independent is an alternative to the Big Four is no longer true, right? They've become effectively organs of the Big Four. The Big Four make their decisions for them, because when you reduce the number of YouTubes to one, the new boss is the same as the old boss. So, it's not ending. It's only snowballing from here. The amount of additional liability and compliance that intermediaries are expected to take on as a result of campaigns waged in the name of artists and protecting our income only goes up from here. Like, you'll remember SOPA? Do you remember SOPA? That was the day like nobody could do their homework because Wikipedia wasn't working, because it blocked out Wikipedia. SOPA said that if you provided domain name services or payment processing, you had to figure out whether or not the domain you were providing infringed copyright. SOPA didn't pass, but now they've gone to ICANN, who managed the domain system, to try and get them to do it. And Viacom sued YouTube, and they took them all the way to the Supreme Court. And Viacom had these crazy arguments, right? Like, one of their arguments was, if you let people make their videos private, then we can't tell whether those videos infringe on copyright. Therefore, any company that makes videos private has to let us see those videos or has to turn off the privacy flag. Well, like, I live in England. My family lives in Canada. I have a child. When I take a video of her in the bath, I want to show it to my parents. I can't attach it to an email, and I don't want to put it on YouTube where everyone can see it. I mean, I'm not a crazy paranoid helicopter parent. I just think that when my kid is 25, she might prefer not to have naked baby videos of her floating around on the internet, which has an infinite memory for that sort of thing, right? So this idea that, you know, you should be liable if you allow people to be private is bananas. But that was just for starters. They also said that YouTube should pay lawyers to review all the material that's uploaded to YouTube in real time before they make it available to the public, or that they should be liable for anything that infringes copyright, anything that slips through the Content ID net. Now, YouTube's currently getting about 128 hours of video every single minute, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, right? If all the lawyers that ever lived re-specialized as copyright lawyers, and they did nothing with every hour that God sent but try and work on YouTube videos to clear them, they would still not make a dent in the YouTube corpus. And of course, this idea, if the principle in law that Viacom established was, if you allow people to make stuff available to the public, you have to have a lawyer review it before they can see it. That wouldn't be limited to YouTube. It would be all the companies that make things available to the public. Every tweet would have to be reviewed by a lawyer. Every Facebook update, every blog post on LiveJournal or Blogger would all have to be reviewed. And again, that now we need multiple parallel universes worth of lawyers to do nothing but clear copyright works before they can be shown to the public. And that may sound impossible, but we actually have a service that works just like that. It's called cable television, right? To put stuff on cable TV, you have to indemnify the cable operator. You have to promise you will pay if they get sued. And they won't accept your indemnity unless you're insured, and your insurer requires you to hire a lawyer to review the stuff. So everything on cable TV is reviewed by a lawyer, more or less. We have, 200 cable TV channels? We were at one point promised 500 cable channels. Do you remember the 500-channel universe? Right? As though that was going to be a lot. Imagine a 500-channel web, right? A web with only 500 websites. How totally impoverished that would be. It would be a web where you could only communicate if you were rich enough to pay or you were under the protection of someone who is rich enough to pay, if you'd signed away all your rights to one of the big labels. And it's getting worse. The Obama administration is currently negotiating with 12 Pacific countries under something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's a negotiation carried on in secret. Congress has not been allowed to see the drafts over the last several years during which it's been negotiated. They were just given their first look at the draft. And the U.S. Trade Representative in the memo that circulated with this draft, this treaty that will become the law of the land in America, said that if the Congress people told anyone what was in the draft, they would go to jail because it's confidential. And America has promised its trading partners, and they've promised America that they won't tell anyone what's in it. Of course, though, the trading partners and their industry representatives all get together in a room to negotiate this, and there's a name for a secret that you ask 500 people to keep? Not a secret, right? So it leaks like a sieve. We actually know what's in it, even though it's secret. So WikiLeaks published a chapter of it this morning. And one of the things that we've seen in drafts of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that they want jail time for people who infringe. So your kid listens to a song the wrong way or watches a TV show the wrong way, jail. They want three strikes, which I'll talk about in the next part of the talk, which is that if you're accused of three acts of copyright infringement, you're required to, your ISP is required to disconnect you from the internet. They want even more liability for intermediaries. And all this is going to do is make it harder to be independent. And the harder it is to be independent, the worse the big five can treat us. So fame will make you rich, but you won't get rich unless you're famous. And no one will buy your books unless they've heard of them. And if the only way they can hear about them is if you sign up to one of the big studios or labels, the studios and labels will pay you as little as they can get away with. They're not charities. So that's the second law. The third law is that information doesn't want to be free. So you may have heard when people talk about this stuff that what they're talking about is that information wants to be free. Have you heard that? Information wants to be free. So I've often been curious about this idea that information wants to be free. I decided to get to the bottom of it. So I rented a cabin in the Hamptons and I invited information up for a long weekend. And we built a sweat lodge. We drummed. We cried about our parents. We drank Oaky Chardonnay. And when the weekend was over, information took me in a strong, manly hug. I felt its whiskers on my cheek and smelled the wood smoke in its beard. And it whispered in my ear its deepest secret that it doesn't want to be free. All it wants from us is to stop anthropomorphizing it. Because information doesn't want anything. And if information wanted something, why would we care? Right? Why would we care what abstractions want? But this is the 21st century. And information technology is at the core of everything we do. And people want to be free. And people can't be free without a free and fair information policy. That's what this fight is about. I don't get out of bed every morning to fight about this stuff because I want to make sure information realizes its destiny. I'm fighting about people. Like they say in Tron, I fight for the user. When we focus on how to regulate the internet as though its primary purpose is to make the 0.0001% of people who earn a living from the arts rich, we miss the main attraction. The internet is not a glorified video on demand service. The internet is not the world's greatest pornography distribution service. The internet is not the most perfect way to recruit jihadis to fight for ISIS. The internet is the nervous system of the 21st century. And everything we do today involves the internet, and everything we do tomorrow will require it. So it's true that digital locks, well, they're a bad deal for creators, and they're a bad deal for their audiences, and they're a bad deal for their investors. But the real cost of digital rights management is that to keep you from figuring out how to save your Netflix video, we made it a felony to tell you if there are any bugs in the Netflix program or in the device that it runs on, like your phone. Because if you know about those bugs, you can maybe figure out how to subvert the program. But that's not the only thing people use bugs in your devices for. If there's a bug in your device, malware uses it. Viruses use it to attack you. And because it's against the law to tell you about bugs in your devices, those bugs last longer before people discover them and patch them. And when you have these reservoirs of long-lived pathogenic vulnerabilities in your devices, you are put at a terrible risk. Because your phone is not a supercomputer in your pocket that you use to throw birds at pigs. Your phone is a supercomputer in your pocket that knows who all your friends are and what you talk to them about and where you are when you're talking. It knows what your lawyer said to you. It knows what your doctor said to you. It knows how to access your bank account and clean out the line of credit backed by your mortgage. Your phone has a camera and a microphone, and it's with you in the bedroom and in the toilet and in your most intimate moments. And if your phone is not secure, the number of ways that you can come to a bad end is almost without limitation. Speaking as a professional dystopian science fiction writer, this is dystopian. And it's just getting started. Because we live in a world that is made out of computers. A modern building, not a beautiful old building like this one, but a modern building with good high-spec insulation, like I hope you have, because climate change is real. A modern building with triple glazing and great insulation, if it doesn't have a computer to regulate its respiration and humidity, that building will fill up with black mold and be uninhabitable. That's what we found out in Florida, right? We turned off the power to all those high-spec subprime houses, and 6 months later, they were so full of black mold that we had to scrape them down to the foundation and start over again. Those big Starkitect towers that we see in all those cities that have been colonized by the finance industry, like New York and Tokyo and Dubai and London, these huge, weird-shaped needles that look like cheese graters or huge erotic gherkins, those buildings, the reason they can be so tall and skinny is because they have computer-controlled dynamic stress allocation that changes the way the building braces itself against the wind and against seismic stresses so they can stay upright. Take the computers out of those buildings, they fall over. Right? Your house is a case mod that you live in. It's a computer you share living space with. And your car is a computer that hurtles down the road at 80 miles an hour with you trapped inside of it. And every year at DEF CON, we see presentations from people who figured out how to use the Bluetooth to disable your steering or take over your brakes. The most salient fact about your car is its informatic system, not its transmission. And we are increasingly in an adversarial relationship with the computers in our cars where we're supposed to not know how they work. Like, maybe you saw that New York Times story about the subprime auto lending industry. It's like son of subprime real estate, where all these people who are bad credit risks, and they loan them money to buy cars, and then they make bonds based on those loans and the loan repayment. And to make those loans as valuable as possible, the cars are fitted with networked location-aware ignition kill switches. And if you stop making payments, well, the first thing that happens if you stop making payments, because it wouldn't be Orwellian enough just to have them turn themselves off, the first thing that happens if you miss a payment is there's a speaker attached to this, not your car speakers, separate speakers that you can't turn off, and they shout at you, "You're a day late on your payment! You're a day late on your payment! You're a day late on your payment!" And they don't stop. For so long as you're driving, they don't stop. But if you actually get beyond a certain period, your ignition just stops working, and then they repo your car. Your car tells them where it is. You can see why repo men like this idea. But the idea that you've got a thing in your car that allows third parties to hijack your car and take it over, that's pretty scary. Like, there are dealers who've had their computers compromised, and every car they ever sold was immobilized. right, in the, out in the field, even cars that they hadn't leased, just because they had these ignition overrides in them. And YouTube, of course, is full of videos explaining how to remove these, and now the auto industry is lobbying for a law, subprime auto lending industry is lobbying for laws that will make it illegal to tell people how to remove an ignition override. Right? If it's illegal to tell people how to listen to music the wrong way, why isn't it illegal to tell people how to steal a car? Right? That's the logic. The unintended consequences are predictably bad. So there was a story, one of the anecdotes in this New York Times story was about a woman who had a subprime lease that said she wouldn't leave the county. And one day she took her kids to the woods, and it was just over the county line. She didn't even realize. So she's at a cell phone range. Nobody else was in the parking lot. She'd finished hiking. The sun was setting. There were wolves, maybe. Her car wouldn't start, right? It had turned itself off because she'd violated the terms of her lease. So we spend all of our times inside of computers. A Boeing 747, a Flying Sun Solaris workstation, in a very fancy aluminum case connected to some very tragically badly secured SCADA controllers. Not only that, though, we increasingly have computers inside of our bodies. If you're my age, you grew up with a Walkman, or if you're a little younger and you grew up with MP3 players, there will come a day when you're going to have so many punishing earbud hours that if you haven't been killed by a self-driving car already, you're going to need hearing aids. And those hearing aids are vanishingly unlikely to be beige, retro, hipster, analog, transistorized hearing aids. They're going to be computers in your head, right? And depending on how they're configured, they'll know what you hear. They'll tell you what you're hearing. They might tell other people what you're hearing. They might stop other people. They might stop you from hearing what you're hearing. Or they might make you hear things that aren't there. It all depends on how it's configured. Now, that sounds like science fiction. I'm a science fiction writer. But we're already in that reality. I'm a frequent traveler. I'm changing the climate. Ask me how. And when you travel a lot, you learn the first rule of the road. Always be charging. ABC. Your laptop's your lifeline. And so wherever you go, you watch the baseboards for electrical outlets. It's your situational awareness. And one day I was in an airport lounge and feeling very smug because I'd seized the high ground. I had the only electrical outlet and my laptop was charging off of it. And a man came up to me very cheekily said, "Can I use that electrical outlet?" And I said, like, "Dude, I'm charging my laptop before the flight." And he said, "Excuse me," and rolled up his pants leg. And attached to the stump of his leg was a robotic prosthesis. And he said, "I need to charge my leg before the flight." So I said, "Okay, you can have the electrical outlet." Now, I saw a great presentation last year, year before, from this guy, Hugh Hare, who runs the MIT Media Lab's prosthetics lab. And I'm a word guy. He's got pictures, though. He's got awesome slides, just picture after picture of people with computers attached to their bodies doing amazing things. Arms, legs, ears, teeth, you know, everything you can imagine. This thing, superconducting magnets that help people with untreatable depression. Everything you can imagine. Right? And his last slide is a killer. Spoiler alert. His last slide is him climbing a mountain, all dressed in Gore-Tex, super ripped, clinging to the rock face like a gecko. And from the knees down, he's got prostheses. He's got cool mountain climbing prosthetic legs. And he's been like standing on the stage like this the whole time. And he's, "Oh yeah, didn't I mention?" He rolls up his pants leg, robot from the knee down, both legs. He said, "Yeah, I lost my legs to frostbite in a mountaineering accident." Then he starts running up and down the stage with these robot legs, leaping like a mountain goat. It's the most amazing demo you've ever seen. Completely killer. So the first question anyone asked was, "How much did your legs cost?" And the price he named, you could buy like a brownstone in Manhattan or a detached Victorian house in Mayfair. So the second question anyone asked is, "Who can afford your legs?" They said, "Well, everyone, right? If it's a choice between a 60-year mortgage on a house and a 60-year mortgage on legs, you'll take the legs." Now, consider what happens when you combine subprime lending and ignition override with legs that don't belong to you. You get legs that walk themselves back to the repo depot when you stop making payments. But you also get legs where if someone can figure out how to impersonate the repo depot, they can turn off your legs, right? So whether that's someone who wants to rob you, or someone who wants to do worse, or whether that's a corrupt autocratic state that wants to immobilize people who are protesting for more rights for disabled people. Stacking the deck against the disclosure of flaws in devices that are in our bodies and that our bodies are inside of, these devices that we rely on for everything, is nuts. even if it means that Apple can't collect a 30% commission on all the software they sell, even if it means that Nintendo can't get commissions, even if it means that Amazon can't log people's books to their platform, we should be able to know about the flaws in our devices. And we should be able to change how those devices work if we don't like what they do. The default posture of our devices should be, yes, master, not, I can't let you do that, Dave. Because we know how that movie ends. And when it comes to increasing liability for service providers, that second law stuff, well, that's pretty bad news, too. You know, if they're getting 128 hours of video at YouTube every minute, well, all the stuff in IMDb is exhausted in, like, the first, you know, 20 days. What's the rest of it? Well, it's everything, right? And it's a lot of really important stuff. It's things like footage of popular uprisings in Gezi or Tahrir Square. It's footage of police violence. It's footage of noble deeds, people rushing in to rescue others. It's moments from history that matter that are captured by citizen journalists. And when we make unaccountable censorship possible through these copyright takedown regimes, some of that stuff disappears because people don't like it. Police departments have used notice and takedown to require the videos to be removed of police brutality. The King of Thailand's used it to take down videos of protesters against his autocratic rule. We've seen it used by neo-Nazis in the United Kingdom to take down material that's critical of them. In this country, Rights Corp, a publicly traded company, has this shakedown racket where they want to send emails to your ISP and have your ISP lock you out of the web so that all you can see is a page that says call Rightshaven because you've been Rights Corp because you've been accused of copyright infringement, and until you give them $20, we're not turning your internet on. Now, $20 is less than it costs to ask a lawyer whether you should give them $20. They've booked a lot of $20s from a lot of suckers that way, and there's no indication that they actually caught anyone who infringed on copyright except by accident. So obviously most of the stuff on YouTube is not Tahrir Square or the Statue of Saddam coming down. Obviously most of the stuff on YouTube is stuff that we shorthand as cat videos, right? Those personal moments. And this is the point where I'm supposed to say the cat videos don't matter, except to the extent that we can't figure out how to make it easy to censor the trivial without also making it easier to censor the momentous. But I'm going to speak here for the cat videos, right? All of those trivial, banal Facebook updates that seem so meaningless. Well, the major reason that those things seem meaningless is because you're not their intended audience, and so you can't decipher them. You know, I'm a 5 a.m. guy, so I make breakfast for the family every morning. My wife comes down for breakfast. I ask her how she slept. And I don't ask her how she slept because I don't know. My wife sleeps next to me, right? I know how my wife slept last night. I know very well if she has a bad night. But I ask her because I have scrambled a message in the world's easiest to decode cipher. And that message means, I love you, I'm thinking about you, and I care about you. And every single momentous message that we've ever gotten, it's cancer, it's not cancer, it's a boy, it's a girl, I lost the baby, I got the job, I lost the job, I graduated, I flunked out. Every one of them. Every one of those meaningful moments that we would all say should be preserved and shouldn't be subject to unaccountable censorship and isn't trivial by any measure, every one of them was grown in a hummus, made of millions of these trivial announcements, these trivial moments. And to say that in order to make sure that people don't read unauthorized books or watch unauthorized movies or play unauthorized video games, we're prepared to make it possible for anyone in the world to make any one of those messages disappear by pointing at them and saying, I aver this infringes my copyright, without any penalties for lying or abusing the system or just being sloppy, that is such depraved indifference and arrogance to your fellow human being that it makes me ashamed to be part of the entertainment industry. The three strikes proposals around the world. The idea that if you're accused of copyright infringement three times, you get your internet taken away. Your family gets their internet taken away. In the U.S., it was never made law, but Victoria Espinel, the former copyright czar under the first Obama administration, she now works for the entertainment industry, but before she went through the revolving door to get an industry job, she got all the major ISPs in this country, which, thanks to the lack of network neutrality, is a very small number. She got them together and made them agree voluntarily that after 6 complaints, they would disconnect families from the internet. And hundreds of thousands of notices have gone out under that program, though, as far as I know, no one's been disconnected yet. In New Zealand, they have this version of it, not Bill 92A. It's actually a terrible story. So New Zealand passed this 3 strikes rule, where your family would be disconnected from the internet if you were accused of copyright infringement. And New Zealanders rose up. They took to the streets. It was like their political moment. It was amazing. And they actually took the law off the books. They said, we're going to have to rethink this. And then you'll remember there was this terrible earthquake in Christchurch, probably the worst natural disaster New Zealand's faced in modern history. And people were buried under the rubble. And they had a special sitting of parliament to pass a bill to clear a budget and send aid to their countrymen dying under the rubble of Christchurch. And a member of parliament, who presumably had been lobbied by someone from the entertainment industry, said, we're going to block this bill unless you attach a rider to it that reestablishes 3 strikes. Right? Talk about depravity. And the United Kingdom, we have this law. It was passed literally on the last day of the last parliament. So in the UK, when we have an election, there's one last sitting of parliament called the wash-up. It's really short, and most of the members of parliament, they aren't there because they've already gone home to start campaigning for re-election, right, because they want to have a job. And so whoever's still there, that skeleton crew, sits and passes whatever laws they need to keep the lights on while they're off trying to get re-elected. And by tradition, nothing substantial, nothing technical gets passed during the wash-up. But they passed the Digital Economy Act in the wash-up last time, and it also has a 3 strikes rule. Now, this is particularly galling because of a woman with the 2 coolest job titles I've ever heard of. When you live in the United Kingdom, you get to meet people with, like, awesomely Dungeons and Dragons-y jobs. Martha Lane Fox is currently the Baroness of Soho, which is pretty cool. Before she was the Baroness of Soho, she was the champion for digital inclusion, which is even cooler. And her job was to figure out how to get everybody in the country connected to the internet. That was her gig. And before she did it, she wanted to find out what happens if you connect people to the internet. Why is she doing this? So in the blighted northern cities of the United Kingdom, where the industrial economy has collapsed, their equivalent of the Rust Belt cities of the American Midwest, there are all these housing projects. We call them council estates. And in one of these towns, there was a council estate that had been connected to the internet for a couple of years. Everyone there got free internet. It was a pilot program. And the next one over, people didn't. So she was like, well, there's a controlled study, right? We look at what these people have that their neighbors don't, and probably the difference is the internet. So PricewaterhouseCooper went in and did this study, and they found that every single thing we use to measure the quality of life in a civilized society is improved when you have access to the internet, especially if you're among the most vulnerable and marginalized people. Educational outcomes went up, likelihood of going on to university went up, social mobility went up, the parents had better jobs, they had more disposable income, they had better nutritional and health outcomes, they were more civically and politically engaged, more likely to vote, more likely to volunteer in their communities. And what Parliament passed in the last hours of the waning Parliament, without any debate, what they passed was a bill that said that if you live in the same house as a piece of networking equipment that someone who may or may not live in that house may or may not have used to be entertained without authorization, that we will cut the single wire that delivers free speech, a free press, freedom of association, access to tools, ideas, to social mobility, education, to civic and political life, to all of those things that we value. And if you needed any evidence that this is not a fight about whether or not information wants to be free, but about whether people want to be free, I think that's it. So I happen to believe that as an artist, I can go on earning my living without being made Lord High Executioner over the internet, without being given the power to censor, to surveil, to control people's devices in their homes and in their bodies. But even if I didn't think that was the case, I would still fight for the free and fair and open internet. Because as much as I've dreamt all my life of being a writer and wake up every morning thankful that I get to do this bizarre thing to earn my living, I am far more committed to bequeathing to my daughter a free and fair world than I am to being an artist in that world. There are millions of ways to earn your living in the arts and trillions of ways to go broke trying. And ensuring that artists who do succeed get as much money as is in the system as is possible is a noble goal. But more than that, artists should always be opposed to censorship. Artists should always be opposed to surveillance. Artists should never be on the side of autocratic regimes and control. We should try anything and everything we can to earn our living from the arts. But if you need to break the internet to be an artist, then you're doing it wrong. You're on the wrong side of history. Thank you. So thank you for that. I will now take some questions. I remind you that a long, rambling statement followed by "what do you think of that" is technically a question, but not a good one. I also, because my Q&As tend to be a bit of a sausage fest, I alternate between people who identify as women or non-binary and people who identify as male. So are there any people who identify as women or non-binary who'd like to ask the first question? The difference between writing a novel and writing a graphic novel. That's great. I didn't write in real life. I helped with the script. The major script work was done by Jen Wang, who is the talent behind that book. She's the one to whom all accolades should accrue. And one of the things that I appreciate having edited her excellent scripts is just how different it is from prose writing. I mean, it looks like a film script. And of course, when the artist writes the script, the stuff that the writer might actually contribute tends to be pretty sparse, right? Like all of the stage direction, draw it this way, put these panels here. The artist can really shorthand that stuff for herself because she's going to draw it. So she doesn't have to be as explicit in her communication. Jen did an amazing job. And not only that, but we went through a couple of scripts, one of which she drew and inked, like, I think 100 pages and then started over on. She really did heroic measures, and she is brilliant. And you should buy everything she's done, including her excellent debut graphic novel, Coco Be Good. Are there any people who identify as male who'd like to ask a question? Yes. So the moment where I figured out that I don't do anything full-time now. The moment where I decided to quit my day job. So I was working for Electronic Frontier Foundation, this nonprofit civil liberties group in San Francisco. And I'd always told my boss that there would come a day when the writing and the day job got in the way of each other. And that because the day job meant so much to me, I didn't want to do a half-assed job. So if I ever thought that there was a danger of doing that, I would tell her. And I did. And 10 years later, after writing full-time-ish and doing lots of other activist stuff, I got so anxious about the way that the digital world was shaping up that I decided I wouldn't write a book this year, and that I would go half-time on Boing Boing, the website I co-own, and that I would go back to EFF half-time. And so I'm back at EFF half-time on this project to kill all digital locks everywhere in the world within 10 years. We call it the Apollo 1201 Project. 1201 is the part of the DMCA that prohibits breaking locks. We do this not because it's easy, but because it's hard. Maybe two more questions? Any women or non-binary people? Go ahead.
Regarding your presentation,
yeah.
What groups or organizations
what can you do to kind of help?
Right.
Yeah. So that's a great question. Gosh, I can't believe I forgot to plug EFF. So who should you look to help make change here? So Electronic Frontier Foundation is a great one. I am and have been a donor for the whole time I wasn't working for them, and remain a donor because the work they do is very impressive, seen from both inside and outside. I've never seen a nonprofit spend money better. The Creative Commons organization does excellent work. The Free Software Foundation does excellent work. The ACLU does excellent work. And I think they're all worthy of your support. Last question. Go ahead. You got one earlier.
Is there any myth, in your opinion, concerning copyrights or...
Are there any myths?
Yeah.
Oh, there's lots of myths about copyright. Some people think that if you don't defend a copyright, it goes away. Has anyone heard that? If you don't defend a copyright, you lose it. So that's trademark, and it's not even trademark. So if you don't defend a trademark, and if someone can show that in the mind of a reasonable person, that trademark is no longer associated with your products and services, then you lose the exclusive right to use it. That has nothing to do with copyright. Copyright is automatic. As soon as you fix a work, right, as soon as you put pen to paper, you have a copyright, and it lasts until you've been dead for 70 years. And you don't have to register it. You don't have to defend it. No matter what happens, even if you let everybody in the world use it all day long, you can turn around and just sue one of them. And even if they can show that you'd let that everyone else have been using it without permission, doesn't matter. So that's, I think, like a huge myth. And the reason it's so pernicious is we get people who are like, well, I don't actually mind what you did, but I'm still going to threaten you and make your life miserable because I'm afraid I'm going to lose my copyright if I don't threaten you. And it's just not true. Like, absolutely not true. So I think that's probably the biggest one. All right. Well, thank you all very much. I'm going to deface any of your books that you'd like and make them non-returnable.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.